Everybody ready for a great day? It's going to be great.
Lisa.
Is that good? Okay.
Lisa.
Yeah, I'm ready.
2, 1. You're listening to The Lisa Show.
Welcome to The Lisa Show. I'm Lisa Valentine Clark.
And I am Richie T.
Don't you wish there was a way to be able to stand in front of huge groups of people without getting nervous? Well, coming up in 20 minutes, we're going to tell you how a small change to your body language could be the answer.
Listen very closely to the words which I am about to say. Crepes are not just a thin, edible pancake. In fact, they are not cake at all.
What?
They are a crepe. It's coming up in your morning buzz.
Hey, it's the middle of the week. We know what you need right now. You need a little encouragement and a little inspiration. We have it here on The Lisa Show, right here, right now, with your everyday rock star.
The Lisa Show's everyday rock star.
Today, we're highlighting someone who one of our listeners, Vinette Rowley, brought to our attention. Her name is Annika Taylor, and here's what Vinette had to say about Annika. You might think Annika is an ordinary woman living an ordinary life, but you would be wrong. Annika is a hairdresser, wife, and mother of two. She loves God, family, her gourmet food club, almost anything that involves exercise, speed, and the outdoors, and cleaning and organizing. The girl literally never sits still. She loves fiercely. And then she goes on to say that Annika has been fighting a battle for her son, who deals with a lot of health issues. Vinette and Annika join us today as our everyday rock stars. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here. Vinette, how do you know Annika?
I know Annika through her sister.
Okay.
I met her sister a number of years ago. We were friends, and so I got to be a little bit of a part of their family.
Well, we love, Vinette, what you wrote about Annika, and it was very inspiring. And I just want to hear from you in your own words about why you went the extra mile to email us and what makes her so special to you.
Well, Annie's the type of person that if you only knew her from social media, you would think that her life was perfect because she's always genuinely happy and she's curious and she's adventurous and she is beautiful and all of these things. But what you don't know is that she struggles just like everybody else, but she manages just to keep it happy and keep on the positive side of things. And I just know that this last year has been particularly hard for her, and just trying to help her son through some hard health issues has been really frustrating. And a lot of us would have just given up and said, okay, I've done the best I can and there are no answers. But Annika doesn't. She just keeps forging through and doesn't accept, less than what she thinks that Banks deserves. And I just really admire that in her.
And Annika, how does it feel to hear these words from Vinette and to be nominated as an everyday rock star?
Well, it's really kind of her and very unexpected, but Vinette's always been genuinely kind and so gracious to our family. So I'm not surprised that she would do something so thoughtful.
Oh, well, and Vinette says that your tenacity is amazing. Where does your determination go, even when helping your son and not being able to get the answers that you need?
I think for all of us, we experience a variety of challenges and trials in life. That's just kind of part of the deal. And I think many experiences previous to my challenges with my son prepared me for how I would have to dig deep to navigate the things that we're kind of going through right now. And I would say probably a large portion of it comes from my faith and just the hope and belief that there's always good things on the horizon, but it takes some grit and digging deep to find them. And my dad is very determined and optimistic and kind of just of the mindset that there's no problem we can't solve if we're willing to work hard. So I think that's probably where it comes from.
I think it's hugely inspirational what you guys have shared, and to be able to recognize someone like you have, Vinette, and be able to put the spotlight on, and I can hear it in your voice, Annika, that this is not something that you've appreciated a whole lot, but that it's uncomfortable to have that spotlight put on you. I want to divert the conversation for a quick second and find out about what a gourmet food club is and how I can get invited to...
I was wondering about that, but...
Oh my gosh, you guys, if you could wangle an invitation from these girls, you would think you had died and gone to heaven.
Okay,
they are the best cooks.
Then I'm going to need to know what are the setups?
Group?
What's the rules? How much do I have to pay? Who do I have to knock off to get in the group?
Because maybe this is the secret to her success.
Yeah, that's where I'm going.
So. Yeah.
Annie, you know are you what? Gonna, it's gonna funny tell? How that evolved. So Vinette met my sister when she was living in Oregon, and I live in Utah. And I met a woman who lived in my neighborhood that I became dear friends with, and she invited me to be part of this said gourmet club. And it basically consisted of six partnerships of women, so there were 12 of us. And we would each take an evening to host a gourmet meal. So like 6-course decorated, you know, full-fledged tablescape and all the kind of hoopla that goes with that. And these other 10 women would just get to come and enjoy for the evening and just be pampered. And we all had a love for good food and beautiful things. And it was in a season of life when my son actually was a newborn. He was like 4 weeks old when I went to my very first dinner.
Wow.
And I was drowning in young motherhood and diapers and no sleep. And so it was just like this reprieve from the mundane day-to-day life that became this passion that I fell in love with. And when my sister heard about it, she was like, I love it. And so my sister's super social and she's a go-getter. And so she started up her own group in Oregon with a bunch of women. And now there's groups like this all over. And the fun part about it is probably, gosh, I bet it's been 15 years later. Now my sister lives here in Utah and she and I are partners in her gourmet club.
Cool.
So it's really fun.
Oh,
cool.
It sounds like such a good idea.
Let me just tell you, I'm not in the gourmet club because I just can't do that. But I have been the sous chef and the dishwasher for a couple of them. So one of them, the host moved all of her furniture out of the living room. It was an Indian theme and she draped her whole room in silk saris.
Wow.
And they ate on the floor on pillows. I mean, the lengths that these women go to, there is a printed menu. There is a themed favor for each person. There is multiple courses. I mean, sometimes they dress. The one theme was breakfast at Tiffany's, and they all wore little black dresses and pearls. And it's just amazing.
Now, Vinette,
wow.
You're just bragging.
Okay.
You're just bragging, and we're not invited. I hear exactly what this is.
No, fun.
I'm just teasing. Vinette and Annika, you are, in fact, our everyday rock stars. You, Annika, for what you have been able to go through and to be able to be positive. And you, Vinette, for saying, hey, you know what? Here's someone doing something amazingly positive and bringing it to our attention. If people want to nominate someone to be an everyday rock star, you can send an email, thelisashow@byu.edu. Be sure to put everyday rock star in the subject line, and we may, in fact, feature you and your gourmet food club in the future. Most people know the saying that once something is on the internet, it never leaves. But is that really true? If you have social media or accounts set up on different websites or even just a computer, it's most likely that your information is out there. So what's being done with that data? Who can see it? And is it ever possible to really get something off of the internet? Whether it's an embarrassing video or something maybe more serious, we want to find out if, in fact, it is possible to remove it from the internet. So to help us, we've invited Haley Kaplan, an internet privacy expert, to share some advice. Welcome, Haley.
Thank you.
So first of all, it's great to have you back on the show. Enjoyed our conversation with you so much before. We thought, man, this internet thing is much bigger than just one 15-minute segment. Let's get Haley back and be able to talk about, is it possible to actually remove something from the internet if it has been put out there?
Yes, but no at the same time. So it's very, very dependent on what kind of information it is. For the most part, in actuality, everything is removable because somebody put it there, right? So if you reach that person, you can remove it, and you can remove it from as many places as it's gotten to. But in actuality and the reality of things is people aren't often willing to do that. So bottom line is you want to be real careful with what you do and what you post because some of it is up there because of stuff you did and some of it is there without your knowledge and without your control.
Yeah, I, as a parent, just anecdotally, I would always say, hey, before you're thinking about posting something online, think if in 20 years you're still going to want to be there. And my son would kind of look at me sort of blank face and I'd be like, and then I want you to think if I might be upset that it's still there in 20 years and hopefully creating those kind of couple of stops that we go, is this something that we really want to have be out there? And that's if we're posting something that we ourselves are controlling. So often, as you indicate, it might be something that somebody else is sharing about us.
Yes, and you know, sometimes intentionally somebody's sharing it for malicious reasons or sometimes innocent reasons, but then there's other stuff that generates from public records, from newspaper articles, and that is the kind of stuff that people like your kid have absolutely no control over, except to behave well in the first place and not do stuff that would cause it to get on there in the first place.
Yeah. When probably most popular, I think about friends, whether they're in real life or just social media friends who have said, you know what, I'm leaving this platform, whatever that social media platform may be. I'm disabling my account. I'm done. I'm gone. Is their information actually gone or is that stored somewhere?
Oh, it's definitely stored there. And I don't recommend that at all.
You don't recommend removing yourself?
I don't recommend removing yourself from a social media platform because if you're not on that platform, you can't see what other people are saying about you. At least if you're on there, you don't have to post and you can control what you're putting on there, but you can still be a voyeur to what other people are posting.
What would be the value in that? Just knowing that if someone is saying something negative or malicious, you can be able to contact it at the source?
Yeah, or unintentional as well. Do you have time for a quick story?
Of course.
So I'm looking on social media, and it was Facebook, and I see a friend of mine who's very influential in the community. And she's sitting there with a big geeky smile on her face, and I take one look at this, and I think, oh, my God, she's at a party, and clearly someone's given it to her. There's people all around her. This is really inappropriate. Imagine what her kids are going to think. Imagine what other people in the community are going to think. So I discreetly call her up, and I tell her, you know, I came across this picture. And she said to me, well, I know, but somebody else posted it, and so I have no control. And I said, absolutely you do. The person that posted it thinks it's funny. It's not funny at all that it's there. You need to contact her and ask her to take it down. And so she did, and the woman did take it down. So that's an example where somebody posted it. If she wasn't on social media, well, I would have found it in that particular case since I went to her. But what happens if I hadn't and no one else was comfortable letting her know that it was there, then it would have been there forever and would have looked pretty bad. You can imagine, you know, a picture like that in the wrong eyes, how that would come across.
Absolutely. You know, I think about these experiences, and I've seen this in our local community where there are businesses that have posted pictures on their you know, their business social media page. And this was fairly early on. I feel like we've sort of self-corrected and people have known better than this. But in the early times of the pandemic, we're sharing pictures. I'm thinking of one that particular was a wedding venue where no one was masked. There were, you know, too many people for the city and local restrictions under the pandemic, and nobody was masked. And I remember the blowback and just bad press that this particular venue got because they had shared a picture that just said that they were disregarding what was going on. And they, of course, deleted it, but several people had screenshotted it before they got the chance to remove it.
Right. And that is one of the things about removing. So once something is removed, if it's removed properly, number one, it gets removed from the site. Number two, it has to be removed from Google, because what a lot of people don't realize is that result can still remain in Google, and there's a teeny little down arrow next to the top line of the Google result. Mm-hmm. And if you click on that down arrow, the word cached pops up, and then you can click on the word cached, and then you can see what was there before it was deleted.
Mm.
So removals are a couple of steps. You've got a number one from the site, number two from search engines as well.
Now, if we want to find out about ourselves, the kind of presence, the stamp that we have on the internet or in the digital space, what maybe aside from Googling, or is Googling the best way to find that out?
There's so many different ways that your information is captured that Googling is definitely the first best step, but it's not the final step. So there's a lot of different ways to Google yourself. You don't just want to put in your name. And depending on the person's name, it's going to be very different because some people have common names.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so a lot of other stuff is going to come up. So you want to start to give Google a little bit more information about yourself as you're doing the search to make sure that you're seeing everything that pertains to you without having to go through all this other stuff. There are specific search terms. There's advanced searches. You can go to Google how to do advanced searches, and that will show you how to exclude certain bits of information, include more. One of the things that I like to do, because one of the services that I offer that's important to people for removing personal information that's not only on Google but on a bunch of different data broker sites. So this isn't the reputation stuff. This is just name, age, family members, address, criminal records, licenses you may own, all sorts of just stuff that comes in from public records, from official public records, and is picked up by those sites. So one of the tricks that I use is to put your name and your address, and that will pick up a lot of the Google results that include your name and address together.
Hmm.
But there's over 300 sites out there that gather that kind of information, and they're not all optimized to come into Google.
Hmm.
So there's some very common sites that are very invasive, very popular sites, and so you want to go directly to some of those sites to find that information and to remove it as well. And we've been talking a lot about social media, but there's so many types of information that come up online that are not social media as well.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't want to restrict yourself to social media because you could be missing out the most important stuff. For example, in my work, I'll have people coming to me with all sorts of problematic posts for them. Maybe they got into a dispute with a customer. Maybe they got into a dispute personally with someone. Maybe there was a sexual harassment situation. And people will create websites just to badmouth and ruin somebody's reputation.
Wow.
So you've really got to be looking for more than official sites.
Mm.
And so the first step of knowing what to do is to be diligent about always looking yourself up on Google. They've got, right now there's all these things on the media about them being a monopoly, but the truth is I find that to be a very handy search engine. It does track everything you're doing. So I also use another one called Epic, but since Google is so popular and so common, it's really important to see what's on there, because what's on Google may not be exactly the same as what's on some of the other search engines. They don't all pick up the identical thing.
Yeah, just using it as another source. We're talking, if you're just listening to us, we're talking with Haley Kaplan, who is an internet privacy expert. You mentioned that a lot of this that we've been discussing, you will actually do for clients, people who come to you and say, hey, help me, you know, remove this information from the internet. Do you find that most people come to you in cases of, you know, oh, I did this silly thing when I was younger and I want that to disappear? Or Is it more they want to be kind of anonymous and not have big data have their information? Who are those that use and patronize your services the most?
That's hard to say because almost every single person that comes to me comes with a different situation and a different set of needs.
Mm.
So, for example, if somebody's been raped or a victim of stalking, what's most important to them is that they can't be found in terms of their home address.
Yeah.
So there's not reputational issues at stake here. It's just really safety. So it's really important that I am very, very thorough about removing anything that would lead to where they are physically located. Then there are people that you mentioned, someone that may have had a misstep, maybe a kid in school had a DUI, and this is following them 20 years later
mm-hmm.
on the internet, and they don't want to be punished forever. I'm about to do a consult with somebody who has a bankruptcy, and that's hurting her. There was someone who had bikini photos online, and she actually told me that she had done a photo shoot when she was underage, and now that she was working for a company, it wasn't professional to have bikini photos up there. The company had gone out of business, too, since then. But when I started to do my homework and my research, it turned out that she really was 18, and she'd entered a bikini contest for a prize and won. Congratulations to her.
Yeah.
And so it really was her actions that caused it to be up there. But when you're 18, you're not thinking, when I'm 28 and these bikini pictures are showing up and I'm in a professional position, that really is awkward. So people have to start to really think about what they're doing and what the consequences are, because they're ending up online. Number one, inadvertently by mistake, people find it out. And number two, when people are unhappy, they're really taking to the online world to let it be known, and they're harming people in terrible, terrible ways.
There is so much that I would imagine, too, that has grown within this space that we're just sort of constantly learning, and things that we would have maybe never considered at the advent of the internet, that now we're saying, oh, this is being tracked, this is being followed, people can find this information. Where for people that are concerned about this, maybe they want to take some things in their own hands, or maybe even hire you. What is a great resource to be able to start to either take back their information or really get an idea of internet safety?
Well, on my website, I have a couple websites. My main website is what-is-privacy.com. And in the upper right-hand corner of that site, I have a blog. And I have dedicated many, many, many hundreds of hours to writing articles to help people about being safe online. So there's that sort of informational guidance on very specific areas. And you can click on one of the subjects that's remove online information, and then you'll find articles related to that. I offer a lot of free tutorials on how to remove yourself from data broker sites. I don't put in a lot of information about removing other types of information because, as I said from the start, it's so diverse.
Yeah.
What happened? I had a client that came to me where one of his clients was very upset, and he put a very pornographic photograph online that was showing up. He is an attorney, and he had a very taboo type of photograph with naked people in the background and him doing something indiscreet. The good thing was, because there was some pornography involved, there are laws associated, well, not laws, but Google, for example, will remove revenge porn if something is breaking copyright. Now, they'll remove it from the search engine, which is great, because they're not saying you have to get it off of the site first, but then there's so many search engines, so you really do want to go to the source.
Yeah.
But when people are using Google a lot, and suddenly, you know, with his law firm, there's this naked picture, it's a huge problem.
Right.
So it's nice that Google has a mechanism, because it fits into the category of revenge porn, to remove it right away.
Yeah.
But then you have to use other means to get to the source, which it was coming from a website that this particular person created specifically to shame this lawyer because he was mad that he wouldn't keep him as a client.
Wow. Wow. And that and these types of things in different ways constantly occurring, people finding new ways to be able to do this. A conversation that I don't know that we'll ever get to the bottom of everything, but that I've really enjoyed being able to talk about how we can remove some information from the internet, and giving your website, which is what-is-privacy.com, as a resource is a tremendous benefit to those that have been listening to this conversation. We've been visiting with
There's another site. I'm so sorry to interrupt you, but I just launched a brand new site called removeonlineinfo.com.
And another great place that people can be able to find out similar, I would imagine?
Yes. I just, because it's new, I don't have a lot of articles associated with it yet, but I intend to put articles specifically related to that over time, at least one a month.
Awesome.
So that will hopefully be a resource, and I've got a contact form if people have questions, because again, we've not even come close to skimming the surface of the subject matter.
Mm-hmm.
There is one of the questions that I didn't quite get to, is everything removable? And I said yes and no. So going back to that, some stuff that can't be removed, there's still things that you can do to lessen the reputation damage. And that's not a service I do myself, but it's still important to know about it, where you build other positive content to push the result down.
Mm.
But first step is always, on anything that's problematic, to try to remove it,
mm-hmm.
because even though it's very daunting and you may think it's never going to be done, just like the person with that photograph, it was, and she was so relieved, and it wasn't that hard to remove in that particular case. And if other people had captured screenshots, they weren't sharing them.
Right.
So that was a good thing.
Yeah.
So
You are a tremendous resource. We hope that we can have you again on the show. Haley Kaplan, internet privacy expert. And we will leave in the show notes those websites that you shared with us. Thank you so much for being on the show with us.
Coming up next, we're going to tell you about the small changes that you should make to your body language that are going to make you feel more confident.
Crepes. Did someone say crepes? We're talking all things crepes in your morning buzz. Why? Well, it's trending. Why? Well, I'm not going to tell you right now. Coming up right after this, you're listening to The Lisa Show.
Welcome back to The Lisa Show. Are you getting sick of the cold weather and making dinner? Both of those two things I'm sick of. Well, in 20 minutes, we're going to tell you about the perfect Indian food recipes to fend off that winter cold. But first, it's time for your morning buzz with Richie T.
It's three things that are trending online right now. This first one, Vernon Jordan, the civil rights lawyer who built a career as a power broker in politics and business, died at the age of 85. He passed away peacefully, surrounded by loved ones, according to his daughter, Vicky Jordan. He was a native of Atlanta. He attended DePaul University, where he earned his law degree at Howard University. After graduating, he devoted himself to ending discrimination against Black Americans in the fight for equal rights. He chaired President Bill Clinton's transition team and for decades remained a friend to both Bill and Hillary Clinton, and passed away yesterday. Texas Governor Greg Abbott, who in my mind, I sort of picture whoever the governor of Texas is as Yosemite Sam. Like, I want them to have two sidearms and, you know, woo! Like, doesn't matter who it is. That's just how my mind works with who the governor of Texas is.
Okay.
He has said, hey, you know what? We're no longer requiring masks in the state of Texas. There are several large companies that function within the state of Texas that said, we're still requiring it.
Mm-hmm.
So individual businesses can, but the statewide mandate to wear a mask in the state of Texas is now gone. As of next Wednesday, businesses will be able to function at 100% capacity. You see similar in other states in the South, Mississippi following suit as well. MISSISSIPPI.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And then
that's
finally, from over on YouTube, there's a channel called You Suck at Cooking, which I really appreciate. No. It's humorous.
I don't want it to be mean.
No, it's not just poor attempts at food and then a bunch of food shaming. No.
It's
maybe this isn't your God-given talent
sure.
to be a
try harder.
Yeah, yeah. But what it does is it says, let's just break this down.
Oh, that's funny.
They break down crepes in their latest video, and they want to let you know that it's not cake at all.
Okay.
Crepes are not just a thin, edible pancake.
Oh, they're crepes, not.
No.
They're
no,
more than
no,
that.
No, no.
Less than that?
No. They're a crepe. Do not make fun of the crepe. It's a great video. If you want to know how to make crepes, if that is not where your talent lies, is in the kitchen, but you know that you'd like to get better or you'd like to try and improve that talent, then this channel is for you. It's trending over on YouTube. The channel is called You Suck at Cooking, and it's crepes. I just keep wanting to say
I know,
crepes because I get a response from you every single time. That is your morning buzz.
Thanks, Richie T. Many of us feel familiar with that sense of dread we sometimes feel before a job interview or a presentation we're about to give or before we go out on stage. It's scary to put ourselves out there. We fear being judged, rejected, or embarrassed. And no matter how many times we tell ourselves we can do it, oftentimes our body language betrays us, giving away our lack of confidence. So how can we change our body language to portray self-confidence even when we're feeling anything but that? Well, joining us today is Linda Ugolo, a confidence and presentation coach, to tell us how small changes in our body language can really boost our confidence and shift others' perspectives about us. Welcome, Linda.
I'm so glad to be here, Lisa.
I'm really fascinated by this idea of the connection between our confidence and our body language. What is it? And what is maybe the things that we're portraying that we don't intend to?
The body is an expression of our inner experience. And so it's always going to be revealing and communicating what it is that we want to say. And what happens is that every movement that we make gets recorded inside our neurophysiology. It's kind of like a circuitry inside ourselves. So let's say people who do a lot of physical fitness, karate, or very strengthening kinds of movements are going to be exhibiting those kinds of strengthening power in their body, and that's how they will come across. People who tend to sit at their desks more and relax. Hmm. When they stand up to speak, they'll have less physical strength in their body to express with. And so they'll come across as more softer or more relaxed. So that's how it's connected between our bodies and how we express ourselves, but also our feelings come through. Because if you're feeling nervous and your body is shaking, or your voice is shaking, or maybe, you know, visibly you're changing color from, you know, becoming beet red, or sweating, then those are like more unconscious ways that our body is communicating, and it's coming through when we're nervous.
So is it possible to sort of change our body language to feel confident or just to appear more confident?
I think that you can, in the short term, you can do it. So for years, when I was nervous getting on live streaming, when it first came out back in 2015, I would do things like jumping jacks and kicks and punches and dance to music to kind of shift my energy. And it would work beautifully for the time being. It would get me into that place. But unfortunately, that's not a long-term fix. I think the long-term fix is looking at what is, in fact, causing you the distress and addressing it at the root cause.
So let's talk a little bit about that. What if we are genuinely just afraid? We're afraid we're going to embarrass ourselves and, you know, ruin our opportunity to get that job or do something up on a stage or presentation manner that would affect the rest of our outcome. Those things are very real. They could have that impact within that moment. How do we push past that stress, that anxiety that would cause us to look lower in self-confidence and be able to deliver on what's expected?
The best thing that you can do is to think about how is it that you want to come across and also how is it you want to feel, and to put that into a mental rehearsal before you have to get into the the situation, whether that's an interview or a job interview or getting on stage. So, for instance, let's say you want to see yourself as calm and poised. You visualize what that looks like and what that feels like. Or maybe you want to feel more animated and dynamic. So what does that look like? And how can you embody that in your cells and tissues? And then you can express that more easily if you've already run through it in your mind. So that's number one. I think when people come to me and it's like, help, I've got an interview tomorrow, or I've got a talk next week, I don't have time to like get down to the root causes. What do? I say this. So if you want to get more specific, let's say you want to, what should we tackle? Should we tackle like doing a presentation or an interview? What do you think?
I think probably presentation is maybe a little bit more applicable, whether it's either presentation or even a participation in some sort of online forum.
Yeah. So, you know, a lot of people are just kind of not thinking that they are on and visible. And so they kind of go into their default way of being. So that may be that you're doing self-soothing movements, like you might be stroking your chin or rubbing your neck. You might be fidgeting with, you know, a pen or a pencil. You might just kind of have a facial expression that is kind of blank and totally relaxed. And they don't realize that showing animation, showing interest, showing approachability is something that you have complete control over. So, for instance, if you sit up straight and you've got like a sense of solidity in your posture, you can do this like, well, you can do this right now. Anyone listening can do this right now. You kind of push down in your chair through your hips and you let your body rise up. Think of it even as like chair fitness, you know, because we're so used to hunching over our desks. But if you're online in a presentation, you want to seem and feel like you are on, you're alert, you're present. So the posture is really important, having a straight back, but a sense of ease at the same time. You don't want to be straight and tense in a military way. You want to give off a sense of ease, and because ease shows as confidence as well, not just like tightness.
I don't want to distract you too much from the topic, Linda, but I think you need to copyright the phrase chair fitness, because mm-hmm. if there's not something like that out there now that people can be a part of on some sort of online capacity, you know that something like that is coming because of where we've been for the last year.
That's right.
Now, I know Richie is distracting you, Linda, from telling us a little bit about the confident body language and what we can do. But as you are a presentation coach, right, and you've really coached people on this and walked them through this process, I'd love to know sort of the sort of hiccups that people come to sort of meet as they're practicing this and trying to incorporate it into their daily lives and incorporate it in a more natural way. What are some of those things that kind of trip them up?
I think that there is an expectation of the self to kind of be in a certain place where you're not. And what I'm saying by that is people want to feel like they should be better at something than they are. And I really try to emphasize that where you are is perfectly fine. And the more present you can be with where you are, the better. And what I mean by presence, and this is key, I mean, you can learn this at whatever level of speakerhood you are at. By presence, I mean connect with yourself. And what do you do when you connect with yourself? You might connect with, well, what position is my body in right now? Like, think about that yourself right now. Like, what position am I in? What does my breath feel like? How open do I feel? How clear am I allowing my mind to be so that I can really listen? Nothing is too small to practice. And I think this is what gets people tripped up. They think that they need to do it all at once. And I say, no, 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 no. Let's just tease everything apart. Just practice presence. Just practice sitting. Just practice opening your heart and your face, your facial expression to kind of like show people that you're excited to be here. Or that you are intensely listening and wanting to hear what they say. So when you take things apart, then you get a sense of, oh, yeah, I can do this piece. Oh, yeah, I can do that. And you can begin to layer on your full presence. So then you're not just thinking about what you have to say and, oh, my gosh, I should do something with my hands. Oh, what is my face doing? Am I looking at people in the eyes? That becomes very complicated. When you break things apart, it becomes much simpler.
So these kind of small shifts that we can get, I appreciate you acknowledging that they might not always feel so comfortable, that we may never get to that point. I think that is an important thing to repeat. That's a huge takeaway for me. Do you have any advice on how we can practice it a little bit more or make it part of our daily habits instead of just,
I think,
confident on this one presentation, you know?
I love that you asked that because there is so much that you can do because, you know what, we are all speakers and we speak all day long. Well, maybe we're, you know, online doing other kinds of things. But truthfully, from the time we wake up till at night, all the speaking we do is spontaneous and unique for the most part. And the only times that we memorize really are for certain special occasions. So we can be practicing our speaking and our body language at all hours. You can, when you go to the grocery store and you get out of your car, you can change up how you walk. Nobody's really going to notice, but you can swagger. You can put your feet flat firmly on the ground as you walk, like walk down the aisles of the cereal row with more confidence and intention. When you speak to your friends on the phone, maybe speak a little louder or smile as you speak and just see how that changes your feeling. Or show people when you greet them that, make them feel like they're your best friend that you just met.
Now, Linda, we only have about a minute left with you, and I want to ask you before we let you go about Delight in the Limelight. This is your book that's coming up later this year?
That's correct.
Tell me, is it an instruction manual for those who don't feel self-confident with their body language, or what is this all about?
I would say it's part memoir and part instruction and motivation. But it is, in fact, a roadmap to go from a sense of fear or nervousness that you have to fun. Because really, if you're going to speak, and we all do, it may as well be one of the best things we get to do.
Absolutely. What is it for you that you love about being able to present or being able to be a coach for those?
I struggled all my life with expressing myself and feeling okay about it. And having come to it pretty late in my life, I don't want other people to have to spend the majority of their life struggling how I did.
Oh, wow.
I want them to feel like this is something that they can take care of now, and then the world's the limit.
I love being able to know that it comes from your personal experience and that you're just sharing that so that others can overcome the same kind of things that you've overcome. Linda Ugalo is a confidence and presentation coach who has helped many become comfortable in their own skin. The name of her book that comes out later this year, again, is Delight in the Limelight. Make sure that you follow her online at lindaugalo.com.
Coming up next, we're going to learn the key to cooking Indian food at home that actually tastes authentic.
You're listening to The Lisa Show. Welcome back to The Lisa Show.
Now, what sounds better than just a heaping plate of buttery naan, a bowl full of curry right now?
You know, I'll tell you what sounds better than that. Nothing. That sounds so good.
Maybe you have one of two problems. You're cold and you're ready for something warm, or you don't know what to cook for dinner, like one more time, right?
Yeah.
I know I've had this conversation on the weekly with lots of people about, well, what should I do? Well, from coriander to cumin, Indian cuisine is known to be one of the most flavorful and nourishing foods around. But many people haven't grown up cooking it, and they might not even know where to start. So thankfully, Kathy Gorey is here with us today to enlighten us with the best cooking techniques, ingredients, and spices that we need to use when cooking Indian food. Welcome, Kathy.
Hi, Lisa. Hi, Richie.
Now, Kathy, your blog's been named as one of the top 100 Indian food blogs, but you're also a screenwriter. I think this is really interesting. It begs the question, how did you get started cooking Indian food?
Well, I've always loved Indian food. My husband and I really liked it, and you know, I did not grow up eating Indian food. I'm Italian on my father's side. My mom is French Creole from New Orleans. Her family came from France like a zillion years ago. And she didn't like to cook. So somebody told me once, some of the best cooks are people whose moms didn't like to cook. So I said, I like to cook. That's all my mother needed to hear, which was like terrific. So I started with Betty Crocker. So how do you get from Betty Crocker to like New Delhi? I like to eat it, but I always like to eat things healthy. I'm vegetarian, don't smoke, don't drink. I'm a runner. What happened to me when I was in my early 30s is I got cancer. So I'm thinking, okay, so I did all these things right. Why did I get sick? So I thought, okay, well, maybe I should eat even less vegetables, tiny amounts of vegetables. You know, maybe I'm eating too much. My doctor finally said, listen, dude, you gotta eat more. Hmm. What do you like to eat? I said, well, I like to eat all kinds of every vegetable, but I thought maybe I shouldn't be eating deadly nightshades. I read a bunch of books. People gave me things.
And everyone has an opinion.
You betcha. You betcha. So my doctor said, he said, well, you like Indian food? I said, I love it. He said, well, why don't you try Indian food? It's really healthy. So I thought, okay. My husband's family has a lot of connection with India. My sister-in-law is a very well-known archaeologist. Her husband's one of the conservators of the Met in New York. And they've both lived and worked extensively in India. So my sister-in-law came out and she said, this is a kind of cuisine for sisters-in-law. Mm. Well, she's my one sister-in-law who really cooks. So my husband's one of like four kids. And she came out and got me started. And it was amazing because I grew up eating like Mexican food in California. And it's the same, many, many, many of the same spices. It's cuisine and it's got cumin and coriander, fresh cilantro, all the things you might like in a nice, any kind of Mexican dish. Those same spices, many of them are found in Indian cuisine. So if you're set up to make tacos at home, or if you're set up to make enchiladas, it's just one little jump to making an Indian recipe.
So for those who are thinking, okay, I'm ready, where do they start?
Well, I started with obviously vegetarian dishes, and I branched out and did everything. But I started with a simple bowl of, I believe it was dal, you know, lentils. And everybody's got lentils. I mean, I've got a very large larder over the years with a lot of stuff in it. And lentils, almost everybody's got in their house, split peas or something like that. And that's where I started. Just something very, rice dishes are really easy. I got a book called Lord Krishna's Cuisine, which was a very large, it came out, I think, I've been cooking Indian food now for 31 years. And this thing came back out maybe back in the early 90s. And it had over 1,000 recipes in it. And that's all I needed. So I started in with that. My husband loves it. He's been to India numerous times. He loves Indian food. And it was like, this was okay with him. Now, he's a real meat eater. Mm-hmm. He likes, you know, it's like, okay, so how do you give a guy, needless to say, anybody else in the family who's used to getting like chicken, steak,
right,
ribs, mm-hmm. you know, it's like, okay, you're going to be really happy with this vegetable dish here. Well, what meat is in it? Yeah. Well, it doesn't really have meat, but if you put legumes together with rice, you've got like a perfect protein. And it's I'll try it. Yeah. You know, you're going to cook it. You're going to do this. Have you ever done this before? Well, no, I haven't done this before. And I had a couple of scary times when I first started, but it's pretty straightforward. And actually, he was really happy, so I started cooking this. I started cooking it all the time. After I finished chemo, I continued to cook Indian food. And I got good at it because I really liked it. But I hadn't tried it on anybody who really, really was from India. So there was a man visiting some friends who was my sister-in-law's. He was one of the directors of the Delhi Museum. And he was in Los Angeles. And somebody said, well, you got to have Kathy cook for you. Because I was cooking for a lot of people in the film industry. But you know, not everybody is like, this isn't Bollywood, this is Hollywood.
Yep.
And so I figured, okay, now what is a real person right from India who is Indian going to say about what I'm doing out here in Malibu, California?
And did it pass the test?
It passed. Not only did it pass, he was astounded. Now, I went out, you know, everything vegetarian and very organic, and I was really careful. He came down into the kitchen and he said, "You are a wonderful little Bengali housewife." And he was astounded that I would do this. And I thought, okay, now I'm in. I made it. You know, I called my sister-in-law. I said, he liked it. He ate it.
I love that.
You know, and then I started getting invitations. It's like, not invitations for me to go someplace unless, you know, I was going to cook for them when I got there.
So Kathy, I have a quick question for you then with this, because people will be listening to this, and oftentimes we almost consider it to be a mystical power that we have here on the Lisa Show, because we'll make these hints of suggestions as far as foods to try or desserts to do. And so I'm sure people listening to this are like, yeah, Indian food. I could probably do that.
I'm gonna try.
Kathy did it. You sort of shared with us where you started. What are some pitfalls that people might find themselves in? What things can we kind of avoid?
And we are running out of time, so we'll have to run through them really quickly.
I'll tell you very quickly. One pitfall is chilies. If you can make something hot, you can't make it unhot. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And if you've got people coming over to your house, you're going to cook something for your family that's really spicy, go really slow, a little bit at a little bit, until you're really used to it. I like hot stuff. Everybody here likes hot stuff in my house. They don't get in my house, so they don't like hot stuff. And if they're in my house and they don't like hot stuff, they got to go. Don't tell them.
No,
but
I won't.
you can really, really always make something hot, spicier. So people make Indian food and it's like, you know, really, really, really hot, to the point where their family goes, "Don't do this again, please. This is terrible. You're scaring me." And so that's one of the big pitfalls. The other one is thinking it's very, very complicated.
Hmm.
Because basically it's not. It's combining a few spices, and you usually heat it with some oil. I use coconut oil, and that's the sort of the beginning. And then as the spices heat, then you start adding things in layers, and that layers in your flavor. And then once you've got your dish complete, say you're making a rice or a dal or any vegetable dish or any meat dish, and actually when you're done, then you have what they call the chonk. And the chonk, C-H-A-U-N-K, is a little oil that you heat. And then you toss your hit of spices that make the final chonk into that. And they go, they hit the as the heat. And then you add that to the dish at the end.
Oh, that sounds so good. Well, now I know what I'm going to make for dinner. Thank you so much for your time, Kathy. Kathy Gorey is a screenwriter by trade, also cooks Indian food. You can find her recipes and tip at thecolorsofindiancooking.com.
Coming up in 6 minutes, we're going to tell you how you can find out if the COVID-19 vaccine is available to you yet or not.
Thank you for listening to The Lisa Show.
Welcome to The Lisa Show.
Hi, this is Lisa.
Hey, it's me, Richie T.
You know what's good for you?
A bunch of things that I can do for the weekend.
Welcome to The Lisa Show. I'm Lisa Valentine Clark.
And I'm Richie T.
Do the new Apple products coming out seem way too expensive to you? Well, coming up in about 20 minutes, we're going to tell you how to time your purchases so it actually saves you money.
And it looks like Dolly Parton's getting a taste of her own medicine. I'll tell you what that's about coming up in your morning buzz. But you know, we get midweek, right? You've had that feeling before where you wake up and you're like, okay, all right, we got this. I got this. Maybe it's bootstrapping. Maybe that's what you call it. Maybe it's just looking toward the end of the weekend. Or maybe it's like the old song, you're working for the weekend. Whatever it is, we're going to help you through those midweek slumps. It's our everyday rock star.
The Lisa Show's Everyday Rockstar.
Today we're highlighting someone who one of our listeners, Vinette Rowley, brought to our attention. Her name is Annika Taylor, and here's what Vinette had to say about Annika. You might think Annika is an ordinary woman living an ordinary life. but you would be wrong. Annika is a hairdresser, wife, and mother of two. She loves God, family, her gourmet food club, almost anything that involves exercise, speed, and the outdoors, and cleaning and organizing. The girl literally never sits still. She loves fiercely. And then she goes on to say that Annika has been fighting a battle for her son, who deals with a lot of health issues. Vanette and Annika join us today as our everyday rock stars. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here. Vanette, how do you know Annika?
I know Annika through her sister.
Okay.
I met her sister a number of years ago. We were friends, and so I got to be a little bit of a part of their family.
Well, we love, Vanette, what you wrote about Annika, and it was very inspiring. And I just want to hear from you in your own words about why you went the extra mile to email us and what makes her so special to you.
Well, Annie's the type of person that if you only knew her from social media, you would think that her life was perfect because she's always genuinely happy and she's curious and she's adventurous and she is beautiful and all of these things. But what you don't know is that she struggles just like everybody else, but she manages just to keep it happy and keep on the positive side of things. And I just know that this last year has been particularly hard for her, and just trying to help her son through some hard health issues has been really frustrating. And a lot of us would have just given up and said, okay, I've done the best I can and there are no answers. But Annika doesn't. She just keeps forging through and doesn't accept, less than what she thinks that Banks deserves. And I just really admire that in her.
And Annika, how does it feel to hear these words from Vanette and to be nominated as an everyday rock star?
Well, it's really kind of her and very unexpected. But Vanette's always been genuinely kind and so gracious to our family. So I'm not surprised that she would do something so thoughtful.
Oh, well, and Vanette says that your tenacity is amazing. Where does your determination go, even when helping your son and not being able to get the answers that you need?
I think for all of us, we experience a variety of challenges and trials in life. That's just kind of part of the deal. And I think many experiences previous to my challenges with my son prepared me for how I would have to dig deep to navigate the things that we're kind of going through right now. And I would say probably a large portion of it comes from my faith and just the hope and belief that there's always good things on the horizon, but it takes some grit and digging deep to find them. And my dad is very determined and optimistic and kind of just of the mindset that there's no problem we can't solve if we're willing to work hard. So I think that's probably where it comes from.
I think it's hugely inspirational what you guys have shared and to be able to recognize someone like you have, Vanette, and be able to put the spotlight on, and I can hear it in your voice, Annika, that this is not something that you've appreciated a whole lot, but that it's uncomfortable to have that spotlight put on you. I want to divert the conversation for a quick second and find out about what a gourmet food club is and how I can get invited to...
I was wondering about that, but...
Oh my gosh, you guys, if you could wangle an invitation from these girls, you would think you had died and gone to heaven.
Okay,
they are the best cooks.
Then I'm going to need to know what are the setups?
Group?
What's the rules? How much do I have to pay? Who do I have to knock off to get in the group?
Maybe this is the secret to her success.
Yeah, that's where I'm going.
So. Yeah. Annie,
it's funny how that evolved. So Vanette met my sister when she was living in Oregon, and I live in Utah.
And I met a woman who lived in my neighborhood that I became dear friends with, and she invited me to be part of this said gourmet club. And it basically consisted of six partnerships of women, so there were 12 of us, and we would each take an evening to host a gourmet meal. So like six course decorated, you know, full-fledged tablescape and all the kind of hoopla that goes with that. And these other 10 women would just get to come and enjoy for the evening and just be pampered. And we all had a love for good food and beautiful things. And it was in a season of life when my son actually was a newborn. He was like 4 weeks old when I went to my very first dinner.
Wow.
And I was drowning in young motherhood and diapers and no sleep. And so it was just like this reprieve from the mundane day-to-day life that became this passion that I fell in love with. And when my sister heard about it, she was like, I love it. And so my sister's super social and she's a go-getter. And so she started up her own group in Oregon with a bunch of women. And now there's groups like this all over. And the fun part about it is probably, gosh, I bet it's been 15 years later. Now my sister lives here in Utah and she and I are partners in her gourmet club.
Cool.
So it's really fun.
Oh, cool. It sounds like such a good idea.
Let me just tell you, I'm not in the gourmet club because I just can't do that. But I have been the sous chef and the dishwasher for a couple of them. So one of them, the host moved all of her furniture out of the living room. It was an Indian theme, and she draped her whole room in silk saris.
Wow.
And they ate on the floor on pillows. I mean, the lengths that these women go to, there is a printed menu. There is a themed favor for each person. There is multiple courses. I mean, sometimes they dress. The one theme was breakfast at Tiffany's, and they all wore little black dresses and pearls. And it's just amazing.
Now, Vinette,
wow.
You're just bragging.
Okay.
You're just bragging, and we're not invited. I hear exactly what this is.
No, fun.
I'm just teasing. Vinette and Annika, you are, in fact, our everyday rock stars. You, Annika, for what you have been able to go through and to be able to be positive. And you, Vinette, for saying, hey, you know what? Here's someone doing something amazingly positive and bringing it to our attention. If people want to nominate someone to be an everyday rock star, you can send an email, thelisashow@byu.edu. Be sure to put everyday rock star in the subject line, and we may, in fact, feature you and your gourmet food club in the future.
Another thing that we're really excited about is being able to have the opportunity to get the COVID-19 vaccine. And with the vaccine becoming more and more available, the possibility of, quote unquote, returning to normal. Now, that's a different conversation, right? But it does feel like it's around the corner. But for some people, especially Black and Brown communities, the vaccine is not as easily accessible as it should be. And with a lack of accessibility, some might be worried to even take the vaccine. So what can we do to help increase minority vaccine outreach? Well, here to give us some tips and tell us more about this is the CEO of Newark University Hospital, Sharif El-Nerhalt. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
First of all, let's back up so that everyone, we can be kind of on the same page as we start this conversation. How has the COVID-19 pandemic, how has it affected minorities in particular?
It's been a really devastating impact, unfortunately, on minority communities. We run the main safety net hospital, the public hospital in the city of Newark, which is greater than 75% minority. And so I just remember back in April walking around and trying to support our frontline heroes in my hospital. And, of course, you couldn't help but notice during the middle of that surge that every single patient in our rooms was a person of color. And so, you know, you had that impact in terms of hospitalizations. Of course, unfortunately, disproportionate death, the number one cause of death, unfortunately, in 2020 for both Black and Hispanic people across the country, as well as New Jersey, our state here. And also the access to the vaccine, as you mentioned, has been more limited. for people of color. First of all, because of hesitancy, that is improving. About 40% of people in our city were willing to take the vaccine as soon as it came just a few months ago. Now, after a lot of engagement efforts through town halls and other engagements, we've been able to bring that up to 60%. But we need to go a lot higher than that, to about 75-80% at least, to get to herd immunity. But then the issue becomes, you know, how do they actually get the vaccine and access it? It's not enough to just put a vaccination center in communities of color. You actually have to make it accessible, considering the digital divide, making sure people can actually call in addition to go online and schedule appointments. So it's been across the board a more difficult time for people of color.
Now, when we talk about hesitancy, as in their, you know, these black and brown communities being hesitant to take the vaccination, why is that?
There's a lot of, frankly, good reasons for that. When I say good, I mean justified in terms of, you know, people's thinking. We have a history where the medical establishment in this country, in addition to just the broader backdrop of systemic racism, has directly targeted people of color. Starting at the time of slavery, you had people like Dr. Marion Sims, who were using enslaved women for experimental gynecologic surgeries. You had the Tuskegee trials, which, again, is in the forefront of people's minds, where people who had served this country, black men, were lied to and enrolled in a study to see what syphilis would do to people untreated over time. And when what they were told was that they'd be enrolling in free health care from the federal government. So this was actually a government study, unfortunately. And so, you know, these are the narratives that ring true in people's minds. And now when we're saying, hey, we're going to have a vaccine which is made available in less than a year, and frankly, it's, these vaccines are great, and the science behind them is totally sound. But we're starting against that backdrop when we're going to the community and asking them to take this vaccine. Yeah.
Well, and you mentioned earlier, too, that in New Jersey, the willingness to take the vaccine has increased by 20% from 40 to 60% of willingness. What are some of the things that you've done to really increase support for that vaccine?
I think it's the overall approach of going with humility on virtual town halls and different engagements and saying, you know, we acknowledge this history. We own it as the medical establishment. We are going to change, but we validate your thinking on this. But here are the facts. And, you know, once you're a trusted party delivering that message, you're able to start debunking some of the myths, such as, you know, does the vaccine cause infertility? No, it does not. You know, is this a conspiracy to do this or that in our communities? No, it isn't. In fact, these vaccines are incredible, really just a miraculous effort scientifically to get these vaccines within a year. The way that the federal government had the will and funding to get these companies to manufacture and develop these vaccines so fast, and the fact that they're so effective. And so once we present the facts after we open that door of trust, we are able to make progress.
We're talking with Sharif El-Nehal about the vaccine and certainly as it reaches minority communities, people of color. When we talk about grassroots, so many times we say, oh, it's a grassroots outreach program that's able to get this to be able to change folks' mind. What does that mean exactly for you there in New Jersey? And then on a national level, what are the grassroots means that we're doing this?
I would say grassroots means really getting as close to where people are as possible to talk about this vaccine and to ultimately deliver it. And so, you know, when we recruit people like leaders of faith, church leaders, imams, other people who are already trusted and convince them that the vaccine is not only advisable to take, but frankly, something that will save people's lives, and you get those allies close to people or trusted by people in the community, then you're much better able to convince people to take it. And that's what we've done. We've had actually events where, you know, clergy are publicly getting their vaccines, of course, virtually, but their congregations are tuning in. We have some in-person events where we're not only vaccinating, but testing and educating. And we're using mobile vans to go to senior living centers and getting, you know, community leaders, other organizations like the NAACP in partnership with us to advocate for the vaccine. That is the most important thing we can do. And then also the data shows that someone's personal doctor, personal healthcare provider is the most able to get someone through their journey to accept the vaccine. And so convincing especially those providers of color to be able to do that is extremely important.
You also mentioned that people may be willing to get vaccinated but might not have access to the vaccine. How do you think that we can increase that accessibility to the vaccine, particularly in minority areas?
Well, one thing to mention is that it's not easy. It's hard work to make sure that we are presenting the opportunity to people who have the least access. So it's not just about throwing up a website. It's not just about saying, hey, go here or there on social media. You really have to understand how people access things in communities that you're trying to target. So we set up multiple ways to get into our hospital vaccination clinic. You can go online, but you can also call us in a phone queue, and we will call you right back. So that gets through the digital divide where not everybody has access to broadband. And then again, doing these informal events where, you know, we are at institutions of trust like churches, you know, with signs, with, you know, the clergy leaders right next to us saying, hey, you know, sign up for this vaccine. We're here to answer your questions. All of those things help, and you have to do all of them. You can't just assume that one thing or the other will work.
You know, if you would have asked me a year ago about vaccinations, I would have said a vaccine is a vaccine is a vaccine. But with over the weekend having the Johnson & Johnson vaccination approved, what does that particular vaccination mean for people of color?
It's definitely a game changer. First of all, just even in general terms, not just for people of color, it's a single shot vaccine. It gets you to immunity much faster, a month sooner. And so that really means great things for getting the country to what we call herd immunity, where we have between 75 and 80% of people who have immunity to this virus. That's when everyone really is protected and we can get as close to the pre-pandemic normal as possible. So it really is adding to the stock as well. We're seeing a 100 million increase in the number of doses by the end of May. President Biden announced that yesterday after engaging with Johnson & Johnson. And so it's an amazing thing really for everybody. For communities of color, it's also important because, again, we've been talking about access to these communities, and you can store that vaccine in normal refrigeration temperatures. So where we have to be creative and more mobile with our vaccine, it's just much easier to do that. And we can also make sure that when we have a vulnerable person in front of us, whether they're homeless or otherwise, we can give that shot and they'll eventually be immune within a couple of weeks and not have to worry about that second shot. And so all of these things matter. And Johnson & Johnson's release is really important for those reasons.
Now, vaccine rollout rates are really beyond our control as a general public, but I know that there are those that still want to help. What are some of those things that we should or could be doing right now to help in those efforts?
Well, the most important thing everybody can do is to talk about the vaccine with their colleagues, their loved ones, their friends, especially people they know who are hesitant, and start the conversation. By definition, you're somebody they know and hopefully trust. And so educating yourself about the vaccine and talking to, you know, people around you, the people you love, will help get folks vaccinated because that will be that many more people getting the vaccine. And so everybody has a part to play in, you know, getting folks through the journey to accept the vaccine. Secondly, look, there's a lot of opportunity to donate, whether it's funds or time, and helping to set up these vaccination centers. You don't have to be someone who is trained to deliver a shot. You can be someone who sort of, you know, mans a counter or helps sort of administer, manage these places, especially when it comes to the institutions of trust and the more mobile efforts. Figuring out how you can help, you know, your local church or institution of faith, or wherever it is that's giving the vaccine, there's always opportunities to do that.
A great conversation around vaccinations, and exciting to know that within maybe even by the end of May that 100 million doses will be able to be administered here in the United States. Sharif El-Nahal, the CEO and president of the University Hospital in Newark, New Jersey, thank you so much for being with us.
Coming up, we're going to tell you about the helpful iPhone functions that you probably don't know about.
And Dolly Parton's joke. Was it a joke or was she being serious? Trending online right now means it's going to be mentioned in your morning buzz. You're listening to The Lisa Show.
Welcome back to the Lisa Show. Now, does keeping all of your old family photos organized seem like an impossible task? You know, there's some here, there's some there.
I know it's on a hard drive.
Right? Well, coming up in 20 minutes, we're going to give you some tips for keeping track of those precious memories. But first, time for your morning buzz with Richie T.
It's three things that are trending online right now. You know Bob Marley and the Wailers?
Uh-huh.
Well, percussionist Bunny Wailer passed away. Oh. Singer, songwriter, percussionist, icon of reggae music, died in Kingston, Jamaica yesterday morning at just the age of 73 years old. Founding member of the Wailers, Bunny Wailer. Also, this is sort of interesting. As they're doing the press junket for Coming to America, that is the sequel to Coming to America, Eddie Murphy and Arsenio Hall being interviewed. And I did not know this, but you remember comedian Louis Anderson is in the original film.
I forgot that.
Plays the role of Maurice, the guy working at the McDowell's restaurant, as I recall. Well, as it turns out, when they were making Coming to America, the producer said, "We need you to hire a white person for this role." They said, "Absolutely no choice. Here are three people. Hire one of them, and you have to do this." The producers were concerned about an all-black cast for this movie. So that's why, and they're like, "We love Louis Anderson. It's nothing about him," but that the production house was forcing them to hire someone. They were like, "All right, we pick Louis Anderson." And guess what? He's in the sequel as well, so you can look forward to it.
Oh, man.
And then finally this. Country singer Dolly Parton, well, she joked because she got her coronavirus vaccination and said, "I guess I'm getting a dose, wait for it, of my own medicine." That, of course, because she donated $1 million to Vanderbilt University to help find a cure for COVID-19. It may be too early to say, but I'm saying Parton for president 2024. You heard it here first. That is your morning buzz.
Thanks, Richie T. Since 2009, Apple has sold over 1.5 billion iPhones worldwide, making it the most popular smartphone company across the globe. But the popularity doesn't just end with iPhones. Apple offers over 27 different products to help ease your daily life. So, how are you supposed to know which Apple tech is best for you? With so many releases, how do you know when to upgrade? Well, to solve all of our Apple tech questions, we have New York Times Wirecutter senior staff writer Nick Guy with us here today. Welcome, Nick.
Thank you. Good morning.
So what are some of the newest we can't live without Apple releases? Because I know that there have been a lot.
Yeah, Apple had a very busy fall. Normally, they have one or two events where they announce new products, but this year, or in late 2020, they had three, actually. So they came out with not only new iPhones, but new iPads, new Apple Watches, and new Mac computers with processors that they make themselves.
So what guides you as to whether, or when, rather, we should upgrade? Because there's always going to be the newest and latest and greatest, but how do we know what we're dealing with isn't fulfilling the function it needs to, or that it's just time to upgrade?
Yeah, at Wirecutter, our stance generally is, and not just with iPhones or Apple products, but across the board, if what you have is working and you're happy with it, don't upgrade just because there's something new. So there are definitely people out there who like to get the new iPhone every year. You know, it's a hobby for them, but we don't think that anybody should feel obligated or feel like just because there's something new out there, they have to get it if what they have is working just fine. And a lot of people hold on to their phone for 3 or 4 years with no problems, and software is getting better and better to make those old phones work well longer into the future.
So I have an older phone, and I'm constantly mocked by my children for how old it is. And it's only like 3 or 4 years
now,
max.
Sure. Now, Nick, it is one of those Motorola brick phones.
Oh, stop it. It is not. It's a 7.
We can't even find a charger for it.
Yeah, but it'll never die.
Yeah. She throws it at the wall on frequent occasion.
Very passionately. No, but really, when we talk about especially technology, in my mind, I feel like these things should last 10, 20 years. Of course, they don't. Because they're so expensive, will we be able to look forward to a day when we do keep our phone for longer than a couple of years?
You know, I don't know about that. I think 3 or 4 years is probably about as long as you can expect. And at this point, we've kind of shifted. So it used to be that you would just buy your phone outright. And now a lot of the phone companies and the carriers are working on leasing programs. So the idea is you pay a monthly fee. And then if you want, at the end of the year, you turn it in and you get a new phone and you start it all over. So they're really kind of encouraging people to get a new phone every year and making it easier to do so. Usually it's a zero interest kind of thing. You're just paying those monthly payments. But, you know, I think that the idea of a 10 or 20 year phone, unfortunately, mm-hmm. just I don't see it happening.
And it seems so wasteful. That's what I'm, you know, as far yeah. as and so what. I mean, that's a conversation for another time, obviously, for that. But I think that the immediate question when people are talking about upgrading their phone or is the battery life, right? And so I'm wondering if you have any tips for us about how we can extend our battery's life.
Yeah, this is actually something we've researched pretty extensively. There's some, you know, I think some sort of folk wisdom out there that you should only charge your phone when it's below a certain percent or mm-hmm. above a certain percent. But what we've found is battery technology, and not just the batteries themselves, but the software that regulates how charging works, is so good at this point that you really don't need to worry about that too much.
Well, that's great news.
Yeah, so plug it in when you have a chance. Don't worry about babying the battery. And battery replacements are actually not too expensive. So if you have a phone that's otherwise working, you're otherwise happy with it, the battery life just isn't there, you can actually have Apple or whoever makes your phone replace the battery for a fairly low price and then get a few more years out of it.
Hmm. So I want to shift the conversation back to the Apple products and the new things. And, you know, we've got Pro Pods and we've got the Air Pro this and.
Are you making up words now?
Yeah. It seems like I am, but then give it 6 months and Apple will say, "Where are your Pro Pod pad?" And you're like, "What? What even?" So speaking about the things that we listen, what is new and what's on the horizon of, maybe we should hang on to our money and buy that next updated version?
Yeah, so the most recent headphones Apple came out with right at the end of the year were the AirPods Pro. The AirPods Max. Steve and I'm getting confused here. So they're, you know, the AirPods, which are those ubiquitous little white wireless headphones that everybody seems to have. Those were, you know, that family, they kind of grew that out with over-ear headphones that are, they're expensive. They're mm-hmm. $550. And, you know, they have some compromises, as Apple's want to do. There's no option for a wired connection out of the box. You have to buy a separate cable if you want that. And you can't actually turn them off, which is an interesting thing. Again, a lot of it goes to the software where it recognizes if you're wearing them or not. And if you're not, it'll go into a low power mode, but there's no on-off button. And we found that they do sound pretty good. But at Wirecutter, we have recommendations for other headphones that sound just as good or better and cost a lot less. In the future, there's a lot of rumors that Apple's working on a third version of standard AirPods. So, you know, we might see those coming this year. And then it also has the Beats line. So several years ago, Apple bought the Beats headphone brand and kept it alive, and they still put out new products. I think a lot of people forget about those because they're often thinking about the AirPods, but Beats is still out there as well.
Okay, so Nick Guy, you are a senior staff writer, and you cover all the Apple products and accessories at Wirecutter. And so, we've been talking about what's kind of trending with Apple tech, but now I want to sort of steer it over to your opinion about having Apple products exclusively or having a brand, whether it's Android or Apple, just exclusively across the board for all of your technology needs. Is that necessary? And if so, what are the benefits and drawbacks about doing that?
Yeah, you know, I don't think it's necessary. A lot of it comes down to just what fits into your life. And sometimes there are choices that you don't get to make. So if work provides your phone or your computer, you know, you might not have an option there. But if you do have the choice, you know, there are benefits to being in one ecosystem. I personally, you know, I have an iPhone and an iPad and a few Macs and an Apple Watch and all that stuff. And what's nice is, you know, if I say add a contact on one device, it's automatically on all the others. The photos I take on my phone automatically go to my computer and to my iPad. So there's some real benefits there that you might lose or at least have to compromise on if you're, say, using an Android phone and a Mac and a PC. You know, I don't think that for most people it's worth getting something they're otherwise going to be unhappy with or can't afford. You know, don't necessarily get the computer or the phone that you don't want just so everything talks to each other in that way. There are usually ways to make it work, even if they're not as straightforward.
The other part of that is it gets hard to get out of the clutches of whatever company if you've started into their products. They intentionally design it so that everything can collaborate, so that when you try and break away from it, you just go, fine, I'll buy that thing. So it talks to, you know, my home this and my that and all those things.
Yeah, I think you're right. You know, I think that once you're in, it's just so much easier to stay in rather than figure out how to get out and how to, you know, if everything's working already, you might not want to figure out how to make it work again in a different way.
Now, you mentioned wearable tech. What's the latest from wearable tech from Apple?
Yeah, so Apple came out with a few new Apple Watches in the fall, and they're minor upgrades to the Apple Watch. But at this point, you know, when Apple first came out with the Apple Watch, I think 6 or 7 years ago, they promoted it as a fashion item, and it was on the cover of fashion magazines, and that, you know, they gave a gold-plated version to Beyonce to wear at Coachella. And since then, I think they've gotten away from that a little bit, and now they've really leaned into it being a fitness device, which is how I primarily use it, is as a fitness tracker. And one of the new software services they introduced in December is called Apple Fitness Plus, and it's actually, you can use it on your phone, your iPad, or your Apple TV, and fitness classes, kind of like your Peloton or any YouTube classes you might take. But what's kind of neat about it is it talks to your Apple Watch. So you do have to use an Apple Watch with it, but it'll talk to your Apple Watch. It'll show your rings that show your physical progress on the screen. And I've actually been using that quite a bit, and it's a pretty good workout service, again, if you have an Apple Watch.
Is it comparable to, say, a Fitbit or another smartwatch?
Yeah, it is comparable. I'd say that it is probably a little bit more feature packed. You can run full apps on it, but you know, it's the kind of thing where you need an iPhone to use an Apple Watch. Again, we're talking about that tie into that system. You know, you can't have an Android phone and also have an Apple Watch. They don't talk to each other. Mm-hmm. But the Apple Watch can run apps independently of your phone. If you have the model with a cellular connection, you can stream music. You can, you know, listen to podcasts on the go to your wireless headphones. And in addition to all that, yeah, it has those fitness features that are very comparable to a Fitbit.
So we've talked a lot about different Apple products. I have a very specific question. What is the best way to keep track of your AirPods? Asking for my children.
It's tough. So there is actually, Apple has an app called Find My. It used to be called Find My Phone, but now they've added a bunch of devices to it. And you can actually see where the phone last talked to the AirPods. And if they're lost, you can play a noise on the AirPods.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I found that it doesn't always work as well as I'd like. But, you know, it's worth at least trying that if you're searching through the couch cushions and everything. Yeah. You might as well tap on the screen and try to see if you can make them beep.
I wish that it was a voice that would say, warmer, warmer.
hot.
You know. So that's actually interesting. There's one Apple product that has been rumored for a few years now. It's almost kind of a joke among, you know, Apple tech writers. It's called AirTags. And Apple has never said a word about it, has never announced it. But it's kind of just accepted that at some point it's going to come. And AirTags are kind of like tile trackers, Bluetooth trackers. But the guess is that they'll use the ultra wideband chip in newer iPhones, which actually is a communication kind of like Bluetooth, but it can tell how far you are from something else that also has an ultra wideband chip. So that would give you kind of that warmer. So we'll see if those come. The most recent rumors are saying they'll come next month, but they've been saying that for 2 years now. So who knows?
See, I make a joke and then I find out it's something that's real.
Any other rumors for releases in the near future?
Yeah. So, you know, we'll probably see new iPhones in the fall again. That's the normal schedule for that. What I'm personally most excited about right now is new Mac computers. I think I mentioned at the top that Apple is now making the processor, making the brains of the computer itself. They used to use Intel processors, which is what pretty much every other PC, you know, any Windows machine uses. But now they're making their own, and they've gotten really good at it. And the first few computers with those M1 Apple processors have been really impressive. So I'm excited to see what newer versions they come out with this year.
Now, Nick, we've talked all about Apple. I'm going to extend the invitation to you. We'd love to have you come back and be able to talk about the far more superior Android.
No, don't say that.
In any sort of choice, there is the Betamax of phones that people might...
Nick, don't get pulled into this. Yeah.
Listen, no. You know, there are some people who are very religious about which system they use. And, you know, my personal philosophy, and I think at Wirecutter too, you know, get what's right for you.
Yeah.
You know, I think there are some great Android phones out there. I personally prefer iPhones. And I could, you know, I think there's check marks in both columns, but,
If I can't speak to it,
I'm sure I can get you someone who can.
Yep, we would love to be able to have that Android conversation. As we've been talking everything Apple with Nick Guy. He is a senior staff writer covering Apple and all the accessories over there at Wirecutter. If you want to learn more about trending tech, follow Nick on Twitter at TheNickGuy or at Wirecutter. Thanks for being with us.
Now, next up, we're going to solve a big problem for you. We're going to tell you all the ways to store old photos so that they never get lost.
You're listening to The Lisa Show. Welcome back to The Lisa Show.
Now, something that I love, which is both wonderful and also kind of tortures me a little bit, is looking at old photos of like when my kids were little or fun memories. And I think that because we've all spent a lot of time at home for the last year, no reason, we have had a chance to be able to do that, to go through. But probably not a week goes by that I don't have this conversation with a friend. I'm being totally serious. What do you do with all your photos? Like, I have some on my phone. I have some. Like, I think I've got some film negatives.
Some film negatives?
No, I do.
Really?
Yes. And it's like,
I think I've got some old vacation slides that I need to convert.
Listen, there's a lot of different ways to store your photos. And so getting them all together in one place is kind of difficult. You know, do you back them up on a cloud? Do you back them up on a hard drive? There's so many ways to do it. But it all seems very complicated and overwhelming, right? So how can we go about organizing them in a way that we'll never lose them and that we'll be able to access them, you know, instead of saying, oh, there's that one photo. Now, where is that?
Now, don't you have a friend, Vanessa Quigley, who not only is the co-founder of the photo book company Chatbooks, but also is like the professional at doing this kind of thing?
Yeah, and she knows how to do this. So we wanted to get her on here to have a conversation about the best way to store our old photos. Welcome, Vanessa.
Good morning.
Hello. We're so glad you're here. And you are my friend. So that's why I have to laugh like that.
Yes, I know.
It's great to hear your voice.
I'm your friend. I'm your friend with film negatives as well. We are women of a certain age that have...
Yes. See, Richie, we're not the only ones.
Listen, I'm just envious of your friendship. I don't have friends myself, so I have to leech off of you guys.
Okay, so we need to dive right into this because, you know, this is something that people want to know. How do you collect everything? So I want to start with your best advice for taking and organizing our photos like in accessible ways. Let's first start with our phones. How can we keep them from being lost or accidentally erased?
Okay, first of all, you just got to make sure that you're backing them up somewhere. I have an iPhone. I back up to the iCloud. I back up to Google Photos. I back up to Dropbox. And I have a hard drive.
Okay, wow.
Okay.
I like layers of protection. But those are all so easy to do.
Okay.
If you have an iPhone, it should automatically be backing up to iCloud. It's so easy to back up to Google Photos. You can do it for free in most cases. And if you have a Dropbox account, I just like that extra layer.
Mm-hmm. And then, so when you're trying to access them from all of these different places, mm-hmm. what's an easy way to organize them?
Yeah, so this is where you can dive deep and make a super complicated system. I'm envious of some of the systems I've seen that people have. For me, I love Google Photos because their AI is like world class. For example, I wanted to find a picture of my cat, and you just type in cat and it pulls up all pictures of cats. I wanted to find a picture from a ski trip. You type in skiing, and I knew this ski trip was in Deer Valley, so I put Deer Valley. All of a sudden,
wow.
all of those photos pop up. That, I mean, honestly, that's the lazy man's way to find photos. But really, my number one tip is just create a regular habit today. Start today. Don't worry about the backlog. And on a weekly basis, organize your photos. Clear out the junk. Really, my backups are so full of screenshots and multiples and duplicates. I mean, sure. that's going to be a lifetime project to go in and clean that up back going backwards. But starting today, every week, I do it on Sundays. I call it my Sunday select. You know, when everything is settled down for the day, I go through all the photos of that week. I delete all of the junk. And then I have folders for each of my kids where I put in the best photos of those kids. Or I've got one folder for the best of the year of our family photos. Doing that little bit of work regularly on a weekly basis saves so much work later when you want to create a book or a slideshow or print the best photos to hang on your wall.
Oh, that's a great idea.
So you queued up those things within our phone, right? Those are digital
yeah.
photos, ones that we just need to store and back up and back up. But you guys both queued up slides. Now, we may need to tell people what a slide in
you
fact is.
You said slide. We said film negatives.
Okay, film negatives. I'm just glad you didn't say daguerreotype because then we're getting
okay.
nice and old. What is the best way to store and enjoy those that are, you know, aren't
old school stuff.
Yeah, the old school stuff.
Yeah. Well, actually, this special year that we've had being home a lot, I've dived deep into the bins and boxes in my basement, tackling my slides. I actually have some slides. They're hand-me-downs from my parents, but I have them. Negatives and printed photos that I never got around to scrapbooking.
Mm-hmm.
I was a scrapbooker back in the day, but now I just have boxes of photos. I followed a course from a woman called Miss Freddy. She has online courses that tell you how you can step-by-step take those physical archives and organize them digitally. Just scanners. I've just been scanning and organizing in clumps of years. I have a stack of photos that were from the house that we lived in Watertown, Massachusetts, a stack of photos from we lived in Connecticut, a stack of photos from our, you know, just breaking up into time segments and then scanning and saving. And, you know, that it can be an overwhelming project. I suggest just knocking that out bit by bit. But getting those in the cloud and safe has been such a relief for
me.
Oh,
I can imagine.
And it's also been so nice to share those with extended family because a lot of those photos, they're of my childhood.
Mm-hmm.
And so my siblings and my parents are getting to look at those and enjoy those. And it's just been amazing. But I have to say, like the magic behind, you know, getting any momentum to do anything with your photos is understanding why you should do it. And it goes back to this theory. It's actually not a theory. It's been tested. It's been scientifically proved that knowing your past, knowing your family story, knowing like where you came from and the ups and downs that shaped your family and you helps you feel more confident and happier and more capable, and it strengthens families. So when you know the why, like why it's important to have this family narrative that is anchored in these photos, each photo speaks 1,000 words. I mean, that's a pretty rich story when you get all that put together.
Oh, yeah.
That's just super motivating.
A quick pro tip on if you have a lot of photos. Most cities have a genealogical society. And within those genealogical societies, there are scanners that are made like how you would do multiple copies into a copy machine. So you can just take
a
large stack of photos.
Yeah.
You bring a thumb drive. You hit you know, scan and it'll just go through those photos for you, put it all on a thumb drive and not cost you a single dollar, your time to go and do it. And most cities, again, have those genealogical societies.
Yeah, that's true. Over quarantine, while we've all been locked up in our homes, those haven't been open. So I invested in a couple of really amazing scanners. But yes, they're starting to open up, and that is a great way to do it.
Now, earlier you mentioned sharing photos with your family, with other people. How can you do that and without putting all those photos on social media?
Yeah, so, I mean, I started a company called Chatbooks. You might be familiar with it, Lisa.
I've heard of it, yeah.
Objection, ladies.
I know, we have to let everybody in on the joke, yeah. I'm the Chatbooks lady. Mm-hmm.
Lisa's the Chatbooks lady, our real mom. But no, like getting them out of your phone and into your hands, like physically, is really important with sharing with our immediate family. We also send books and prints to my parents, to my siblings. But we have a shared Dropbox with my extended family where we have everything organized where people can access and enjoy. I like to create little, Google makes it really easy. And actually, your iPhone makes it really easy to create little slideshow and memories. And I will sometimes send those off to family. You know, my mom was just recently diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And now more than ever, it feels like so important to capture these memories that are so fleeting for her in a more permanent way that she can hold on to and look at and reflect and help keep her with us longer.
You know, Lisa mentioned the way to kind of keep these things secret, but there are others of us that want to share the ridiculous photos of ourselves when we were younger. Are there new forthcoming trends about how to share photos that would be different than, say, like your Chatbooks or like your Facebook or Instagram?
Trends for sharing publicly?
Yeah.
It feels like every day a new platform has come out. I know TikTok, I've been seeing lots of people putting together little slideshows and putting them up on TikTok. I know my parents aren't on TikTok and they're the ones that care the most about my photos. I feel like, you know, I don't really share a lot of our personal family photos on social media, but I have a really large extended family. I'm the oldest of 12 kids. They're like 60 grandkids. So our family group text and WhatsApp thread feels a little bit like social media.
I'm sure.
And that's a fun place to share some of the more embarrassing, revealing photos, that everyone gets a laugh out of.
I love that you talk about having your why. Between, you know, why you take pictures and the benefit that it can have for your family. I think that the tendency, especially for parents, is to take a bunch of pictures of their kids, but maybe not like their everyday ordinary life or pictures with them in it. Talk to a little bit about how you've seen the power of being able to take those sort of everyday common photos.
Yeah, the in-between moments. That's what I refer to them as. When we were first parents and we had a big, nice camera and you had to buy film, it felt like every frame was precious. And we found ourselves only pulling it out for, like, the dance recital and, you know, the spelling bee and, you know, the big events. But as I look back through those photos, it's really those in-between moments, like, you know, kids sitting around the table at dinner and I didn't even know I was taking their photo, or a child playing quietly in the hall. That is what really captures the essence of what this family life is about. I'm also a huge advocate for taking pictures of the hard times, because when we talk about our family narrative, we don't, a story that's just all happiness and rainbows and unicorns, you're like, that's not compelling. It's the hero's journey that we love, right? That's what we pay money to go to the movies to see that story played out. And that is the story that is really going to create the strength and the grounding that our families need. When they need to know the good, the bad, the big, the little, like all those in-between moments is what really adds richness and depth to our family narrative that will, you know, create that base, that security where our kids can, like, dig their feet into and cling to. Because really, that's what it's all about, right? It's all about strengthening our families and giving our kids this, like, sense of history that helps them know who they are and what's possible for them.
Vanessa, we got about a minute left. I'm curious, what are the pitfalls? What am I going to end up doing wrong?
Yeah.
How is he going to mess this
up? It's overwhelmed by all the photos in the past that we haven't done anything with. And honestly, I get overwhelmed even just in a week of photos and videos that I take. So something is better than nothing. Start small. Start today. Set a regular weekly habit to deal with the photos that we are currently taking, and then set small baby little bite-sized goals of how to tackle the stuff in the past.
I love it. All right, I will. I'll start today.
You got to do it. Not just pictures of your rescue dog, Robert, but pictures of you and your wife as well.
And the hard times. I actually appreciated that sentiment quite a bit. Vanessa Quigley, the co-founder of Chatbooks. You can find them online at Chatbooks or her at Vanessa Quigley. Thank you for being with us.
I think that's a doable thing that we can all do today is just to say, hey, you know, I'm going to go ahead and just take some pictures of like what my house looks like right now, whether it not all cleaned up, you know, not pristine, but like room from room. I know that as I've looked back at my childhood photos, I've appreciated those in between moments, you know, those pictures of, oh, I remember that.
Yeah, so many photos. That's what just keeps playing again
Don't
and again in my mind. I know. Start today.
Start
today.
The Lisa Show is a production of BYU Radio. You can find everything you need on the BYU Radio app where you can listen on demand. You can also find us on Sirius XM. We're on channel 143.
Now, if you subscribe to The Lisa Show, you'll know that there are lots of episodes in the past. Don't go in the past. Start now listening to every single moment of The Lisa Show.
On tomorrow's show, we're going to tell you what you need to do before you even attempt to grow a garden on your own.
Thank you for making The Lisa Show a part of your day.